A sea of iron crashed down on all the front and support lines. The noise was terrible, impact after impact. The whole of No Man's Land was a seething cauldron. The work of destruction grew and grew. Chaos. It was impossible to imagine that anyone could live through it. It was like a crushing machine, mechanical, without feelings, snuffing out the last resistance with 1,000 hammers. It is totally inappropriate to play such a game with fellow men. And these were the words of one of the British soldiers on the morning of the 15th of September 1916, during the early stages of the Battle of Fleurs-Courcelette, which will have been 106 years ago this week. And I thought it would be appropriate to record a podcast remembering what happened on that day. And to do so, I've turned to a man called Peter Smith, who's a historian and tour guide who actually lives in the village of Fleurs, where some of this battle took place. And before we tune in to what Pete had got to say, let's just have a look at another account from the other side of No Man's Land that was written by one of the survivors of that tank attack, by a German soldier. And he was in the 5th Bavarian Infantry Division, and his name was Lieutenant Braunhofer. And this is what he said: a tank appeared on the left front of my company position, which I immediately attacked with machine gun and rifle fire, and also, as it came closer, with hand grenades. These unfortunately caused no real damage, because the tank only turned slightly to the left, but otherwise just carried on. He crossed the trenches in the area of the company on my left, caused us heavy losses with his flanking machine gun fire on trenches which had to a large extent been flattened, without my men being able to do anything against it. The British account that I read, the first ones that I read there, came from a book called Bloody Victory, The Sacrifice on the Somme, and that was written by a man called William Philpott. And the German account was taken from Peter Hart's superb book, simply called The Somme. So here we go then. I recorded this interview a couple of weeks ago with Pete on Zoom from his home, as I say, in the village of Fleurs, in the heart of the Battle of the Somme. So first of all, just an introduction about yourself then, Pete. How on earth did you end up on the Somme all those years ago? And where did your interest in the Great War come from?
Yeah, well, I've been here now. It's getting on for 20 years. I think I actually tried to work it out. Literally, I was working it out while I was sat in the bath. And I just, these things pop into my mind. I thought, I keep telling people it's 20 years. Is it 20 years? Well, it's near on, damn it. It's 18 and a half that I've been here. And it's really, it's a lifelong, I suppose, interest in the Great War that started with my grandfather's medals and a mum that was interested in rummaging in junk shops. And sadly, this is, you can't see this, but I'm surrounded by books and memorabilia, and that comes from my mum. I've got the collecting gene. No, I've discovered over the years that you've either got it or you haven't.
Yeah.
And so it's that as well, and it's buying postcards. I was very interested in postcards sent from the front, and at one time I collected what was on the front: comedy, photographs of soldiers. And then suddenly you start reading the back and you realise that the backs and the comments from home to the front and back again. And that fired my imagination. Grandfather's medals, grandfather's diary. So I was able to follow his route across the Western Front. So it's all that kind of slow, interest that you get from the family, from what's around you. War memorials in the village. No, I just was drawn to them and started reading the names on the war memorials. And that takes you a step further to wanting to know about the people. So even when I was at primary school, our teacher, I had a very good history teacher at primary school, or a headmaster who was very interested in local history. And so that fired me up. And it's all those outside meetings with people and people you pointed in a direction that eventually led me to led me to join the military.
Because I was just going to say that you served, didn't you?
Yeah, and it was unlike a lot of people, they get an interest in military history having joined the military. I decided that I couldn't seriously, and this is the age of 21, that I couldn't carry on doing military research. It didn't feel right to be that interested in the military without having served. So I joined the Royal Marines, and served just for 11 years. It was an experience. It was never going to be a career move. I just wanted it to be that experience. Sadly, I didn't see any, well, not sadly, depending on your viewpoint, really. I didn't see any combat at all. And in
No,
fact,
it's about timing, I suppose, wasn't it?
But I had the timing right in a way, because it was the first war for a long, long time, and that was the Falklands War, was in my period. But I was training at the Commando Training Centre, or instructing at the Commando Training Centre, and so I didn't go, which has always been a bane. Whenever anybody mentions the Falklands, it's just gone past the 40th, and a lot of my, obviously, the chaps I joined up with went. And no, it's a normal question when they know I served in the military. Do I need to go to the Falklands? No, I didn't. But on the other hand, who knows? You know, so you have to look at everything. And my son, who also served in the Royal Marines, a very different career. Three tours of Afghanistan.
Blimey.
Very.
And so presumably it was wanting to be a guide that took you out to the Somme in the first place.
Well, not exactly. It was, we wanted to do bed and breakfast. So we came out here to set up a bed and breakfast. And what I found is that I was doing more and more touring. So people would come and say the bed and breakfast would want a guided tour.
Yep.
And so I was quite capable of giving them a guided tour.
So
and slowly but surely, I did more and more guiding. And then you're losing the balance when I was sneaking home to try and avoid my clients in the bed and breakfast, because I needed a break from talking. And so that's when we shut the bed and breakfast down and went straight over to just doing the battlefield guiding, which is great.
Work with the Australians, you mentioned we were talking off air. How did that come about?
Yeah, it's a story of friendship and people, you know, as most things are. And I was doing a bit of guiding here locally for people staying at the B&B, and suddenly a fellow guide here said, "Pete, I've got some Australians coming. Could you cover this tour?" And I said, "No, all right then, I'll give you the go," as you do. And you think that's the only way to learn, is to do something different. And it was a student group over Anzac Day, and this was the it must have been the 90th, I think, 90th anniversary of Anzac, maybe earlier than that. But anyway, it was an interesting one, and it went very well. And I also bumped into several other Australians who ran tour companies at the same time.
Yeah.
And so from that, they said,
"Just
would you be interested
gradual
in working
process,
for?"
Then.
Yeah, it is like most things in life.
It
you know,
is.
Slowly, your circle of friends grows and grows, and opportunities arise, and and so now full time, and has been full time for many years now, almost 15 years of full time guiding, because this is my profession. It's not a casual profession. I have a young family, so I need to work. So it's more than just a casual interest.
And it is getting back to normal now after the gradually, though. But the Australians, as you said to me off air, are coming back in smaller numbers at the moment.
Yeah, it was a tough 2 years. The first year was actually fun to a certain extent. I have a young family, and to spend a year with them. You know, when you're working, something that's extraordinary. The French government was supporting us, but the second year became more crucial. More critical. We'd been spending our savings as well to keep our head above water.
Yeah.
The French government stopped paying about three quarters through the second year, and so it suddenly became tough. And certainly, we couldn't have done another year, and we would have had to bail out and sell the property.
Yeah.
But so just.
Thankfully.
Just got through it here,
and
work's picking up. And this year, we hope this year will be a normal year. It definitely is not a normal year, as we're discussing. Ypres is still fairly quiet, one of the larger touring towns for the battlefields around here. You don't see as many English or foreign cars than we used to,
no.
But it's improving slowly.
It's
so,
better,
yeah,
isn't it? Yeah, I noticed
it
that
is.
The other week.
Yeah, it is.
So the reason that I wanted to talk to you. Apart from the fact it's always good to talk to you, Pete, is
thank you very much.
you live in the village of Fleur,
yep.
And the 15th of September will be, how many years is that then? 106, isn't it? 106
it is,
yep.
He said, not working it out at all, so I'm just agreeing with you here. Yes, it is.
So I thought what a good idea it would be to talk about the Battle of Fleur-Courcelette and the arrival of the tanks. And I thought, I know a man who lives in the village where a lot of this took place. So I thought we could have a chat about that, and I'm sure people will be interested in discovering about it. So, first of all, what's it like to live in a place where such a famous battle took place? I know there's a famous memorial almost outside your house, isn't there?
There is. I mean, it was a deliberate choice when we were looking for properties to buy, that the criteria really had to be on the battlefield. So it meant our guests for the B&B could open the door and step out onto the battlefields, and something kind of that was memorable. Interestingly, this was the only property we looked at. It was absolutely spot on for what we wanted. Outbuildings, a building to renovate, a main house, and so just exactly what we're looking for. And in the village of Flare, we immediately thought, "What are we going to call the place?" And we thought, "Dinnerken," the name of the tank
Of the
that literally
tank, yeah.
drove past the front of the house on that day, on the 15th of September, 1916. Very oddly, at exactly the same time, somebody moved into the other end of the village to do a letting property rather than B&B, and he pipped it at the post, and he called his property Dinnerken. And I had all the business cards created, and everything. Just one of those utter quirks of
It is,
fate. And I
yeah.
remember sitting down in the front room with him and saying, "Oh, what are you going to call your house?" And he said, "Dinnerken." I said, "Oh." I said, "How far have you? How far have you got down that route?" He said, "Well, I've got the sign made, and I've had this made and this done. I've got the website started." I said, "Well, I've got my business cards done, but that's it." So I said, "Okay, I'll withdraw." And interestingly, he helped pay for my business cards for reprinting of them.
Oh, that was nice
So it was
of
a good start. Yeah, good start. So yes, yeah, so it was a deliberate move to come here. And I have to say, my tank knowledge was okay, and that's
him.
because I'd lived very close to Bovington. So before I
Yeah.
moved out to France, we lived only 20 minutes away from Bovington. Normally had a yearly pass, and that's where my first set of children came on. Almost every weekend, where we're going, kids, I tell you what, let's go down to Bovington, go to the Tank Museum.
Just tank
So
museum, yeah.
yeah, and it was a place again that I'd known about since childhood, because I'd gone there regularly with my parents on our holidays down to Swanage. We'd then go across to Bovington and to Swanage. So yeah, so there's almost a continuity. So extraordinary to be now living here where it all happened.
So tell us a bit about the what was the plan for the 15th of September 1916, and
Yeah.
whose idea was it that the tanks, why were they called tanks, and what did the Germans know?
Okay, well, there's several people. Some of the listeners will know names that we're going to quote. Some will not. I suppose the most important guy was Churchill, and Churchill forms the Landship Committee in the February of 1915. They're
Because that's what
already
they
out.
called them to start with, landships, not tanks.
Exactly. So that's what they're looking at, land ships. And what it is, it's a development really of the armoured car, because the Royal Naval Air Service were using armoured cars in 1915, whistling about and trying to pick up downed airmen. That was the original idea. And then they're used as semi-offensive. And so it's a development of a car with armoured plating. And they thought, well, let's take this a step further. We've got Caterpillar tractors. We've also been using a Caterpillar tractor to tow the big guns. So perhaps we can develop something from that. The two kind of crucial names, William Triton, MD, of a company called William Foster and Co. And that's in Lincoln, and they're an
Lincoln,
engineering company. And a chap called Walter Wilson, who's a naval officer. Now, the two of them, basically chalk and cheese, but working together, brilliant. And so they start designing basically what will become known as tanks. And let's get that out of the way. Why are they called tanks? Well, it's a name because if you imagine how these things are being built, they're being built with steel plates riveted together, and very much looking like a tank. The early tanks had square boxes on the
water
top.
tank.
Yeah, a water tank. So it looks like a water tank. And in fact, Mother, who is the forerunner of the tanks, and Little Willie, I suppose Little Willie more so, Little Willie, the first real working tank, just had a box on the top of it. So it looked like a water tank on tracks, basically. So it was a simple way of camouflaging. Let's just call these things tanks, and covers a multitude of sins. Yep, so Colonel, another name to reckon with, Colonel Ernest Swinton of the Royal Engineers. He then dives in and starts trying to work out how we should use these. And we get this ongoing development of the tank. And this is all taking place in 1915, 1916. Big Willie, which is basically, and sometimes I think more appropriately known as Mother, is developed and then trialed at a place called Hadfield Park in Hertfordshire, and it starts really, I was going to say, gaining legs, but you know what I mean. It's progressing, it's moving forward, and they're realizing that this is actually going to work, and can be used. Literally, I was reading up about it this morning because I'd always have a quick whiz through. And one of the most interesting things that I found was one of the problems they had was with the tracks. The tracks, if it went over a trench, the tap tracks would go loose and that would cause a problem. So they needed a way of keeping the tracks taut as they cross trenches. And just a simple thing like that caused them immeasurable problems as they
As they
were
were being
developing.
tested. Yeah.
So ongoing testing until it becomes viable, and we get the 29th of January 1916. There's a demonstration to the great and good, and 4 days later, Kitchener gets a look at it. Now, Kitchener was not impressed, and he described it as a pretty mechanical toy, which
Toy.
which didn't go down well with the people there. And in fact, it's interesting, since Kitchener was very keen on aeroplane development, and yet he just didn't view the tank at that point as being particularly going anywhere. But anyway, it didn't make any difference. The Army Council, who were there, and they made that decision then to place an order for 100 tanks. So the first tanks, just after the 29th of January, in fact, it's 4 days later, is when they scribble out an order for 100 tanks.
And a lot of these are made in Lincoln, I understand.
They were indeed. I think there was two factories that were making them. Lincoln was one, and I forget off the top of my head where the other one was, but I think generally speaking, when most people think of tanks, they think of Lincoln. And of course, the Landship Act kind of comments, again, very similar to the way they're created, great steel plates bolted together. So you get a feel of battleship as well, or warship. And even the guns that are going to be built into sponsons at the side, so effectively turrets at the side, not on the top, have the feel of some of those guns slowly going out of use. But down the sides of the ships, there are these sponson turrets on the sides of ships, not the big kind of capital guns on the top. And one of the reasons I quite often get asked this during tours is, why did the tank design not have a turret on the top? Were we not capable of making them? Well, of course we were. We're building battleships with great big turrets. Turrets would have been easy. It's just that the center of gravity would have been very high for these early tanks, especially going across this absolutely mangled terrain that we all recognize from the Great War. And the second thing is that the engines are dead slap bang center in the middle of the tank, and the turret would go slap bang center in the middle of the tank. So effectively, all the heat of the engine would be going up into the turret constantly. So it wouldn't have been a good place to have
And it made you pick a
a
target as well, I
turret.
suppose, wouldn't
Yeah,
it?
exactly.
But
Yep,
what about,
as
so at
well.
what stage did they have the idea then of having a female tank and a male tank, and what's the difference?
Yeah, well, it's a ridiculous situation, really, I suppose, or not ridiculous as we look at it. It's accidental, not enough 6-pounders. So the 6-pounders for the male tanks, so they have a 6-pounder gun at each side,
This is like a
and
small
the
cannon then, a six
it
pounder is
is,
like
yeah.
a
So
small cannon.
the Navy had some. They were again for ship defence, and the Navy had some spare ones, so they had a look at those. They're known as quick firers. Quick firers means that the breech system works quickly, but it's also the fact that the actual projectile and the case that has the strings of cordite in that ignite to thrust the projectile out are in one piece. So it's like a bullet, effectively, for those of you that know exactly what a bullet looks like with the projectile and the case. Well, a 6-pounder shell is the same. It means you're just whacking one thing rather than several things to fire it, so it's quick. So quick fire is 6-pounders, one on each side, and then supported by a Hotchkiss machine gun, which is a French machine gun, also in the sponson. The French machine guns, they thought, were ideal because they fed with a metal strip, whereas other machine guns, the Lewis, which was another option, has a circular drum on the top, bit fiddly to fit, and the Vickers a belt which again could move. So they thought it was probably a good idea to use these metal strips. But the original question: not enough barrels. So not enough barrels of these 6-pounder guns. So they thought, crikey, what can we do? Well, we'll have to make some. We're going to call them females, and these will have twin Vickers within each side. So each sponson, each side, two Vickers per sponson at each side. I don't know how successful the female tanks would be, because it must have been very difficult trying to feed the belt through.
With everything else
With
going on in the
a
tank.
cloth belt, yeah, with everything else going on, and certainly when they fired, I think the Vickers could be fired when the tank was on the move. So the females had the capability of firing when on the move, whereas the six-pounders most certainly didn't, because the gunner has to look through the sights, and the vibration when the tank's on the move meant that he wouldn't be able to see anything through,
yeah, it'd be impossible
through the
to
sights
fire.
of the gun.
Yeah,
exactly.
Excellent.
Speed, perhaps I should mention. I'm going to go off
very
on my
slow,
own thing
it?
now. So speed, yeah, between maximum around about 3 miles an hour, 5 kilometers an hour. So very, very slow. And that's the first thing we need to really mention is these things are lumbering across the battlefields. These are not whistling across the battlefields. The Mark One, because that's what we're now going to be talking about.
Yeah.
The Mark One tank, slow. So it's almost less than walking pace, which then explains, and it's one of those things that I remember reading years ago about officers or men getting out of the tanks in the dark to lead them by walking in front of them. And I remember thinking, well, if the tanks are, this is, I suppose, as a child almost, thinking, well, why aren't the tanks going to run them over? But actually, just at the walking pace, he's keeping ahead of the tank all the time anyway. And so
the natural
also,
reaction for a civilian like me would be to get behind the bloody thing.
Yeah, exactly. I think they only walk them into position. I don't think they walk them into the attack. Not a good idea to walk.
I'd still be behind it under any circumstances, but another civilian.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, tripping up and falling. And saying, oh, could you just... Yeah, not a good idea.
I'm a civilian and a coward. So they've gone quite quickly then from having the approval in September to be having them ready during the Battle of the Somme. It's only a few months later, isn't it? And they've managed to keep this a secret from the Germans.
They have. I think that's the interesting thing. I mean, they did all sorts of... Because, of course, they've got to get them here. So they've got to get them out to France as well. They do that by trains. There are no tank transporters, as we would now see them occasionally on the roads. You'll see something carrying a tank, a big truck, basically a flatbed truck. Well, they are flatbed trucks, but they're on the back of railway wagons. And so they drove them on. They made special tank loading parks. They have to take the sponsons off, so that the turrets on the side need to be removed, because they were basically, they're wider than the railway lines that had been designed at that time. So they are sponsons are removed, and they're covered in sheets with Russian, is it called Cyrillic writing? I think that's the name, Russian writing on them. So the people again are confused if they've had a look at one and think, well, where's that going? Well, it's obviously going to Russia, whatever it is. So all of these things, again, subterfuge and camouflage, so that spies would not know what they are or where they're going.
Because there's German spies operating behind the British lines in France and also in the UK.
Yeah, exactly. So get them then to France. And they've already built training areas in France behind the lines. And in fact, there's been a lot of development on the battlefields recently, or behind the battlefields, by these local towns which had tank parks close to them. So these are towns up near the coast. And whenever I'm kind of exploring in that area, I come across signage in some of these villages with information about the tank parks and the people that were there. Interestingly, and perhaps something we should talk about later, including the Chinese Labour Corps, because they use the Chinese Labour Corps in the tank parks for stripping engines. They became very dexterous fingers, good at learned very quickly, and became very good at stripping tank engines for tanks that were being refurbished behind the lines. I'm drifting off what we're supposed to be talking about.
Yeah, we always do, don't we?
Yeah. My tangents are legendary, going off on tangents.
That's fine. I've got a list here of things to talk about. We'll catch up.
Yeah.
So they've got them over to the battlefields. Where have the tank crew come from? Who are they? Are they machine gunners?
No, interestingly, they're not. They're men normally with mechanical aptitude. A lot of men from the cyclist corps. The guys who had joined the cyclist corps. Obviously, the gunners are from the artillery.
Yeah.
Some of the drivers are coming from the army service corps, because they seem to have a mechanical aptitude in the motor vehicles, and so they're from all over the place.
And how many make up a crew?
A crew of 8. And that's the standard number. But there was not an opportunity, because there was another firing position behind the at the back of the tank in the middle of the two tracks, and so occasionally they would have a 9th man. But in the main, it's 8 men, 8 men
eight
in the tank
inside. Yeah. What is, if anyone's seen the tank at Bovington or anywhere else, these are still.
Yeah.
This isn't a big space, is it?
No, it's
it must have been an awful.
Yeah, awful,
working environment, I suppose, is the phrase I'm looking
Yeah,
for, before you even
absolutely
start
horrendous.
fighting the enemy.
Yeah, many years ago when we had running tanks, I went to a an open, more of an open day. It was an invitation. I think it might have been the Western Front Association, but I forget now. And they actually fired up a tank for us, one of the ones that was still running. And the noise is just unbelievable. It's truly unbelievable. And sadly, none of them run any more original tanks. I think the last one went to the that was still actually mobile and moving. Still an original tank. It went to the unveiling of the Tank Corps Memorial in London. And it was when it was on its low loader on the way there that they realized it had fractures all over it,
Oh,
all
really?
over the subframe. And that, so that was the last time that
Just
one, and
time, isn't it? Just
it's just
time.
tired. Yeah, just tired out. It's worn out, and the vibration slowly breaks down the metal. So none of them run, sadly, none of them run any longer. But yeah, it's the noise, the fumes, and I think that's one of the things you have to think about. Engine in the middle, fuel tank in the middle. Fuel tank is gravity fed, so it's actually above the engine, so it's high up in the tank, difficult to fill. So you've got the smells you would get will be the engine itself, and engine oil burning in the engine. The exhaust obviously leaked, so you've got exhaust fumes coming in. The noise levels and vibration would give you white finger. For anybody that's used a drill or something for a long time, you'll know that the vibration stops the blood circulating. Well, they got white everything, presumably because the tank was shaking when they were running. The heat would have been extraordinary. Of course, in combat with the guns firing, you've got the fumes from the guns every time they fire the guns. I mean, people would pass out in a tank without anybody even shooting at them,
Just because of the heat.
but because of the heat and the
Then when
lack of
they are
oxygen.
shooting at them, they've got splinters, metal splinters on the
Yeah,
inside.
yep. So you've got the danger of the metal splinters splash. Basically, something hits the outside, it doesn't penetrate, but the shock waves flake off the
And
inside.
a
So you've
direct
got
hit is setting fire to the whole thing, isn't it?
oh, I mean a direct hit. I mean, these tanks were designed only to withstand, hopefully, bullet hits and light shrapnel, i.e., lead ball bearings. But anything else, any jagged pieces of steel flying at thousands of miles an hour, red hot, are going to punch through, as are any shells will go straight through as well. So, and anything hitting the fuel tank. And the more difficult thing about these early tanks is the Mark Ones, excuse me, and most certainly the females' Mark Ones, they had very limited exits. So for the in the in the turrets on the sides, they had doors at the back. Those doors had to be half height for the female tanks because you've effectively got a Vickers machine gun above you, firing above you. So you had to go beneath it. Full size doors for the gunners on the male tanks, but still very limited access, entry and exit to get out in case anything happened
Sheer panic,
inside.
wouldn't it? Be sheer
Oh yeah,
panic
horrendous,
trying to get out of
horrendous.
there.
Yeah,
In.
yeah,
So, right, we know what it's like to be inside the
yep,
tanks, and
yep,
we now come to the Battle of the Somme, and we've
yep,
gone through the first stage of the Battle of the Somme being the 1st of July, and we all know what happened there. Second stage of the Battle of the Somme is what we call the Battle of Bazentin Ridge.
yep.
And then we get to the third stage, which is breaking the German third line. Would that be right?
It is, yeah, that would be right. And of course, this is kind of where it becomes interesting, because certainly the initial, I suppose, instigators of the tank, and that would include Churchill, didn't ever view that the tanks would be used in what I could describe as piecemeal. It was generally thought that the tanks would be used when we had literally built thousands of them. We'd ironed out all of the little issues that we had, and those issues would be the speed, would be reliability, and to a certain extent would be tactics, and that's something I'm going to come back and talk about as well. But Haig is now getting desperate's not the right word. It's just that what he really could do with is, before winter sets in, and basically, as we know, the Somme battle will peter out in the Somme mud. 19th of November will be the end of the Battle of the Somme, and so here we are, 15th of September. He really would like some success with the hope that we might be able to break through. But at the very least, we will capture Bapaume, which had been the objective from the beginning. And we're not that far away. I mean, I can see back home from here. So not literally from, but certainly from the ridge just behind us, which is one of their objectives. You can see.
But that tells me then, from what you're saying, that Bapaume being the objective, the initial objectives, and now they're hoping to take the tactics have changed from being this massive breakthrough that's going to end the war to the bide and hold tactics. Is this evidence of that?
But what's interesting is when they're planning this battle, they are planning for raids against German positions, over 20 kilometers from here. Now, so that shows you that they are excuse me, that they are still hoping for a potential breakthrough. And he had brought up the cavalry units. I scribbled down how many. Five cavalry divisions were being prepared for this attack. So again, it's still there. It's still there. This hope that if everything went absolutely perfect, then would we still have a big enough break in the line that we can punch through with the cavalry and start and the German front line collapses?
I suppose
My
it's like you
personal,
said, it's before the weather changed, isn't it? They didn't know at this stage in October and
no.
November the rains were going to come like that.
Indeed, and of course, we're on the cusp of the worst winter for 40 years, so it's going to be a particularly bad winter as well. So that's the overall plan. Still, let's look at the objectives of that first day, the 15th of September. It's basically to clear four lines of trenches, four objectives, clearing two important lines of trenches, and the most important being the switch line. And effectively, where I'm sitting here now, towards what is now the old British front line, up on the ridge, just on that ridge is the switch line. The other side of the village, we have a position known as the Gerd line. And both of those are very strong positions, and both will need to be taken during this battle for us to have any hope of further forward movement. And the village sits firmly as a defensive fortified village in between those
In
two
the middle.
lines. In the middle.
So this is the third line that they've been building behind the first two lines. And
Correct.
this has only just been constructed, I suppose, only just been finished, hasn't it, at this stage?
It has, and of course, if we take the story and kind of spoil this story by saying that this is going to, as some of the you who have read anything about this will be a successful action. Where we are in Flers, it goes well, and most of the objectives are taken. The immediate objectives are taken, but effectively, all it'll do is bog down on the far side of the village. That will become the front line for the winter. And you're absolutely right, though. This is not the German, preferred positions. They've been pushed off their preferred positions. But of course, what they've got 20 kilometers behind here, further back, they have the Hindenburg line. And in the winter or in the spring, late winter, early spring, they will fall back to the Hindenburg line without being pushed back. They will, I mean, we're going to chase them, but they will fall back onto their Hindenburg line. So you could say the operations taking place now, yes, they may aid the German decision to move back to the Hindenburg line, but we're not really moving them back very far. We're only moving them back a couple of kilometers, if that.
No, but it's hindsight again, and
Yeah,
and
exactly.
they're learning all the time, aren't they? They're learning.
Correct. I mean, this is a massive, and it's what I often describe to people who are horrified at the losses. It's a massive learning curve, and no more so than tanks. No, because and that's what I was actually going to get round to. You would think there would be some instructions or some guidance about how to use these tanks. Well, there is, but it's very broad and it's to everybody. And basically, they're saying this is how you should use tanks in the broadest sense. So their fine tuning of their use of tanks is by the divisional commanders commanding each division, because some are going to be allocated to each division that's going to be used in the battle. So there is no one. You can't say, oh, in this division they use them like this, in this division they use them like this. It's all the same. It isn't. It is literally different the way that the tanks are going to
Because
be
they've
used
spread
by
them
each
out,
division.
the 40
They
odd of
had.
them. They've spread them
They
out
had.
amongst the different divisions, and it goes as far as Courcelette on the other side of the main road.
Yeah. I'm going to run through the divisions that take place, but really we're only going to be looking at two, and that's the ones that are relevant to this
Around the village.
village. Yeah, and that's the 41st Division and the New Zealand Division, and the New Zealand Division allocated four, and the 41st Division allocated 10. The allocation of the tanks, they looked at the landscape and looked at what were going to be the problems, and then they allocated the tanks to that degree. That's going to be a harder nut to crack, so we better allocate some more tanks
That reminds
there.
me, when we were talking about the name of your home, you didn't actually say what it was called in the end.
It's called Otago View
That's
because
when you
yes,
said
you're
about the
right.
New
I see
Zealanders.
what you
That's what
mean.
reminded
I
me.
see what you mean. Yes. So when we didn't name it Dinnerken, what did we name it? And it's very, very relevant. People think, well, why is it called Otago View? Well, literally the farm that I live in, that we're recording this from, or I'm recording this from now, basically is where it was a German strong point. And during this battle, the view from here was of the Otago Regiment as they crested the rise near to the New Zealand Memorial, where we now have the New Zealand Memorial. More about that later. And so it's a machine gunner's view of the Otago Regiment,
That's your home.
hence Otago View.
Wow.
No, we,
So yes,
yeah,
the plan.
so let's just talk about the divisions. So this is the Fourth Army. The divisions that are going to be used, and this is from right to left from our perspective. So the perspective of us looking towards the German lines, 56 division Combals or thereabouts. These are just the nearest town I could think of. 6th division at Lebouf, Guards division at Lebouf, 14th, which is one of the light divisions at Gardecourt, 41st Division at Flare, New Zealand Division at Flare, 47th at High Wood, 50th Division at Martinpuis, 15th Division also the other side of Martinpuis, and the 2nd Canadian Division at Courcelette.
There's some famous regiments there, aren't there? Famous
There
divisions
are
there.
fa famous divisions, there are, but it also shows you this is not a minor action. No,
No, it's massive.
this is
It
a massive, massive
is.
attack. And it's a renewal of the offensive, basically. After a pause, it's the renewal of the move for us to move forward. And just about the just overall view of the tanks is that it was decided that the tanks, if everything went right, should reach the enemy positions 5 minutes prior to the infantry. That was the plan. It isn't going to work, but that was how it was thought would be the best use of tanks. If they could get there just
Cause
ahead of the
destruction.
infantry.
So in the area of Fleur, then we've got two divisions, including New Zealanders. What actually
Yeah.
happened?
Right. Well, I think I'll talk about the New Zealanders first, because this is a very important location for New Zealand. We've got a New Zealand Memorial here. So on the ridge, I can see it from almost everywhere in the house, certainly the back of the house and the garden. Rising above us on the high ground behind us, then we have the New Zealand Memorial. Just over that ridge, on the left, to the left of it, we have the village of Longueval, which is also on top of that ridge. And behind both of those, we have a cemetery called Caterpillar Valley Cemetery, and that's where the New Zealanders who died in the battle and whose bodies were not located, or whose identities of the bodies were not located. We have the memorial to the New Zealand missing of the battle here, and also importantly, the unknown New Zealand soldier was removed from that cemetery as well to go back to New Zealand. So I think it shows you how this is an important action. It's their first set piece battle for the New Zealand Division, and it's a real blooding for them here. But it's very successful, and it's successful when they're having a really tough time. So let's just talk about their objectives. Their first objective is an objective known as Crest Trench, and this has to be taken just ahead of the general attack, which is at 6:20 in the morning on the 15th of September. And then they've got to crest the ridge, literally, and attack the switch line, which is a reverse slope position. It's on the other side of the ridge, this high ridge that gently slopes down to my village. And that becomes their first real objective, to take
And
the switch
this
line.
switch line, if I remember right, it went right the way behind High Wood and then up
Yeah.
IZA and across the road.
It does. So it's the bit that we're interested in is basically on the left. It's High Wood, so it's coming from the corner of High Wood. It's running just on the reverse slope of the ridge. It runs down then into the valley, and it heads across towards Gerdecourt
And they've had a few goes at taking it
Morvallen.
in the weeks before, haven't they? The
They
Australians.
had, and the Gerd line is a tough nut to be cracked. So it's an important defensive position. So New Zealanders very successful in taking the switch line and heading down into the valleys and some little gullies, re-entrance, I think that would be the proper term for them. Hardly visible, they're not much. I once had a New Zealand lady when I was taking her up this valley called Butcher's Valley, and she said, "Peter, this isn't a valley in New Zealand. This wouldn't even be commented upon. And I said, ah, but nobody's firing a machine gun at you. When they're firing a machine gun at you, this becomes a very important valley because it gives you an element of shelter.
Yeah.
So it's all in the eye of the person that's there. So shall I talk about Butcher's Valley now? Yes, I shall. I'll talk about Butcher's Valley now. It gets the name Butcher's Valley for a very interesting fact, and that's the fact that a Lieutenant Butcher passes a message to a tank. So it's the very, very first passing of a message to a tank in combat. And it was Lieutenant Butcher.
Butcher's in the infantry. He's passing a message to the tank.
He's an infantry. Yeah. Strictly speaking, it was his Batman that's hammering on the side of the tank trying to find where the door is because he didn't know where the great... It's a great little story.
He's never seen one before, has he?
No, I haven't got a clue. Didn't know where the door was. His officer said, can you give this message to this tank? And he kind of trying to flag it down. So he's walking alongside it, banging on the side of it,
with all the
hoping
noise
that somebody, hoping that somebody's going to notice him, and eventually somebody does. Tank stops, door opens. He passes the message, and even more interesting for me, that message is that there's a machine gun firing us, causing us quite heavy casualties from over there on the right hand side, and that over there on the right hand side is actually where my farm is. So it's one of the guns firing from the area around my farm, and that tank is then dispatched to protect the infantry. And so it's the first, I suppose, coordination between infantry and tanks. So,
it's
remembered, yeah. And that was actually to a tank called D-12, commanded by a chap called Nixon, and he's the first man to receive a message from the infantry.
Did he survive?
He did. Yeah, he went survived. I'm not sure about long term, but he certainly survived this action.
He survived that day, yeah.
So he did. In fact, just as a by the by, of the four tanks that are fighting for the New Zealanders, there is only one man killed in that.
So four tanks, I know some of them broke down. Were they allocated more than that?
No, they weren't. Oddly, all four went into action. All four. Two of them are knocked out and two of them, get back.
Yeah.
Both by 77mm field guns. And just one death, Gunner William Debenham from one of the tanks. And sadly, they tried to find his body after the attack when they could clear, when they went in to try and find him. Never found him. So he's one of the missing.
The tank crew were New Zealanders.
No, they weren't. No, these are British tank crew. So it is a gunner. So he's obviously from the artillery. So Gunner William Debenham.
And he's on tape now.
Yeah, it was one of the other options of when we were thinking of naming this house. We thought, should we call it Debenham House? And we thought, no, that's going to be confusing. We'll think it was some kind of supermarket. No, so,
that's Gunner our Debenham. First tank man killed.
Yeah, he was. Certainly, he may not have been the very first, but he's probably the first to become killed and missing. I mean, I may be wrong. I'm sure somebody will correct me, but he's the first.
Births, anyway.
Exactly.
That time in the morning, the first attack.
Yeah.
And that must have been one of the main reasons then why the New Zealanders achieved so much that day, if all four tanks allocated them actually performed.
Well, there's a fantastic... I think that the tanks supporting the New Zealanders do exactly what was envisaged of tanks, because certainly D-10 that is knocked out in Fish Alley eventually was operating on the left, and the left-hand side of the New Zealand attack is a massive problem. And that's because the 47th Division, which was London Territorial Division, was due to fight through High Wood and had not got through High Wood.
No.
So what it meant was that the New Zealand left flank was completely open. It was completely open, so they had fire coming from that flank all the time.
This happened so often, didn't it, when multiple divisions were attacking?
Yeah, and so their left flank was open. So this is why the New Zealanders did extraordinarily well, considering the problems they had. So open left flank for the whole of the day. Nobody there. So one of the tanks trying to support that side, and then they had another problem: is that the 41st Division, which are on their right, literally fighting through the village, had lost most of their officers. And they'd actually taken the village. They'd actually pushed on outside the far side of the village and then fell back because there were no trenches and they didn't feel comfortable. And the only trench that they knew of was back on the other side of the village. So they started falling back, right back through the village that they'd actually taken. Not because they were under German pressure. I mean, they were under they were under terrible shellfire and machine gun fire, but more not being forced back by the Germans, more because they didn't know what to do. Not enough officers,
because all
very
their
few
officers are
officers.
gone. Yeah.
Yeah, and so they started falling back, and so for a short period, the New Zealanders had both of their flanks open at the head of their attack. Nothing on the left, no 47th Division, nothing on the right in the village, 47th Division had fallen back, so they had to go right as well. So they had to they took over and held on to while the 41st reorganized itself and moved forward again to occupy the village.
Well, that must have thinned out their lines then, New Zealanders.
It did. But what they had, which I think this is again a great showing of how the use of tanks, a chap called Purcell, who was commanding D-11, who was by then due to fall back. They got an order to fall back the tanks. Tanks could only run for a limited number of time. Their sprockets started stripping because of the power of the engines. They had all sorts of mechanical issues, and they knew that they only had a limited time. Also, just from the amount of rounds they had, 334 rounds for the male tanks, so quite a few rounds they had, and 24,303s for the females. So they could occupy, they could work for quite a while. But D-11 either didn't get the order, or they think more likely he recognised that the infantry were having problems. And so he decided to move himself forward in front of the village. And he's recognised on that day to potentially be the most forward tank on that first day of tanks. And he sat himself there in front, and he stayed there all night protecting them. So
this is what always gets me. Again, talking as a civilian, I know you're a military man, but as a civilian, I always think this is incredible, because you've got all these plans, all these orders, generals.
Yeah.
It's down to one man's intuition and bravery that has changed history, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I always look at the New Zealand, the tanks working, the New Zealanders are doing what they're supposed to do. They are staying with the infantry when they need them. They're protecting the infantry with their guns, and then he fell back the following day. So again, he survived it, which is even more amazing that he survived it and fell back.
Brilliant.
And so effectively, New Zealanders had a very trying day, terrible casualties, but they took nearly all of their objectives there. I'm not going to go into details because this is a general overview of tanks on that day. But the confusion that reigns at the front line is something that still hasn't been solved. We still have the problems with communication. So we're getting New Zealanders told to fall back from positions, then told that they need to retake them. So they have to retake them, having taken them at terrible cost. They were told to fall back and then to have that countermanded, and they have to attack again. So we get a terrible loss of life for no
it's
reason.
It's chaos, isn't it? Even though
it is.
Things,
yeah,
it presents different problems to if you don't achieve the objective, doesn't it?
You spread out. Just two final things I want to talk about with the New Zealanders, because I think they're both interesting. And then these are names that still exist, certainly for people that guide on the battlefield. So we've got Butcher's Valley, which is just behind us. My kids have a tree house in a bank there so we play amongst where all this was going on. And that same location, we have a little thing called Bogle's Post. Bogle's Post, Bogle is the medical officer for the New Zealand. He's moved forward as they take the village. He moves his medical post forward into this bank where we have these trees, and just to the left of Butcher's Valley. And Bogle was killed there. He's a medical officer, New Zealand medical officer, and he was treated as if he'd been wounded because they want him off the battlefield because of what he's done to keep so many alive during that day. And he's moved, and he eventually will be buried in Quarry Cemetery at Montauban. But to me, that's when I go there and play with the kids, it's always we're going down to Bogle's Post. And it wouldn't have got that name until slightly later on during that winter of 1617, as we're still holding all of these sites. It would then have got its name as Bogle's Post. But I just like to remember him when I'm there. So that's Bogle's Post. So yes, one final thing I must say. The Germans, first time they've seen, so let's look at
that
from
was
the German
my next question
perspective.
If you're a German soldier, don't know anything about this.
Terrified.
You must know that something's happening because of the bombardment. Yeah. They're still doing a bombardment.
Yeah, they did. Yep. So very good creeping barrage. The other thing that I ought to say, which is quite interesting, that the tanks, they've allocated alleys. So they knew where the tanks were supposed to go. The tanks had been given a route in. And they decided that they were worried about the tanks. If they're ahead of the infantry and there's a creeping barrage, they're going to be in the creeping
They're going to go
barrage.
straight into it, yeah.
So what they did was they created alleys in the creeping barrage where there was nothing
Where there's
being fired there, which is interesting, isn't it? It must have been very difficult to do, but it also means that literally where the tanks were running up those alleys, the Germans were not being shelled in those
No, they
alleys
must have
because
wondered
the
what on
creep.
earth was going on.
Yeah,
But
I
even
remember
then,
the
the
what?
learning period, look at this is only what, 6 weeks after the 1st of July. And not only have
Oh,
we have been in a
technical.
creeping barrage, we've then amended it to make
To
allowance
get
for tanks
the tanks. Yeah,
within
I mean, it's
6 weeks.
extraordinary, and we wonder why it didn't go quite as to plan. You know, it's yeah. I mean, it's extraordinary. I mean, you need well-trained gunners to create these alleys for the tanks to drive into.
So the Germans then, yeah, they're
So
one of the people.
Germans, surprised. They, as we discussed earlier, they knew nothing about the tanks, no idea. So it's all a massive surprise to them. There's a very good first-hand account from an artillery gunner who sees these things coming, and he's just terrified. Big problem with the guns. The guns are in fixed positions that gave them limited traverse. So they can go up and down, and they can go left, right a little bit, but they cannot follow a tank. Now, for an anti-tank gun, because there is no such thing at this period, you
No.
need to be able to follow a tank, get slightly in front of it with your barrel of your gun, fire it direct fire into the side of the
Machine
tank.
guns. These are the
No,
machine guns.
no, I'm talking about 77 millimeters
Right,
because the
right.
Germans have always got frontline protection from their
Right.
artillery. So there's a couple of
Yeah.
frontline guns here, right in the so
Right.
these batteries couldn't follow the tanks because they're in fixed positions where they can only go up and down, not left and
Not
right.
left or right, no.
Only a little bit left and right, you know, because normally they're firing quite a long way away, so you don't need a lot of left and right. But if a tank's coming towards you, across you, so most of the gunners had to sit still in their gun positions, waiting for a tank to literally drive in front of them, so they could then fire because they
They must
couldn't
have been crushed.
traverse to
They
follow it.
must have been
And
crushed.
the problem with the tanks are they very often miss the guns, and they drove the gunners underground. And certainly for some of those tanks that were supporting the 41st Division, which we'll cover in a second, the gunners were driven underground. The tanks thought they'd killed them all and driven them away, ignored them, and then the gunners
They
came
popped
back up
up.
again and waited for the tank to come back. And when the tank swings round and goes the other way, they got them. So some of the tanks were hit by from guns that they thought had been taken. Probably the most famous is in the Bulls Road, where Bulls Road Cemetery now is, Commonwealth War Graves Cemetery on the other side of the village, on the east of the village. Then that's where there's a very famous German gun position in Bulls Road that took out a tank that literally waited. They bided their time. I think the tanks in that case went right over them. But the gunners went underground and then
And
waited when it
came
went
up.
quiet, and they got it on its way back.
Oh, blimey. He must have thought he'd done his job.
But the gunners themselves, they were terrified. A lot of the Germans terrified. What I was actually getting round to is the New Zealanders didn't take prisoners.
No, I
They
bet
were
this.
they were told not to take prisoners, and they didn't feel the need to take prisoners, and they were worried because in the half light they were going downhill. If they took prisoners or they didn't clear the ground properly, how would they know who surrendered, who hadn't, and they'd be behind them? So on a sloping ridge, which means that they'd get a good view of them. So they decided not to take prisoners, but sadly, or not sadly, but. Importantly for the Germans, they could see from their positions, and they wrote via the Red Cross and complained that the New Zealanders hadn't been taking prisoners because they'd seen packs of New Zealanders hunting down Germans who were trying to
Trying to run
surrender,
away.
and then bayoneting them when they caught them.
Oh,
So
gosh. You just can't imagine, can you?
no, you
This is
can't.
medieval
No,
stuff, isn't it?
it is, yeah, and it's
Oh.
horrific to us thinking about. But of course, these things still happen today,
Yeah.
and in warfare, no. If you want to win, then sometimes
It's
there
ruthless,
are
isn't it?
worries about prisoners behind you, about having
No.
people that may or may not be prisoners, and you can't tell, and so you decide we're not just not going to take
This is
prisoners.
one of
So
the
the New Zealanders,
fascinations, isn't it? Again, talking as a civilian, trying to understand in my head how a man could do this, could be in that situation. I don't even know what I'm trying to say. How what it was like. It just can't imagine the thought process that would have gone through any of these men on either side, you know, the British or the Germans. It's
Well, he's not normally, he doesn't come into this story really, but Arnold Ridley was here on the 16th, so the day after, Arnold Ridley from Dad's Army,
Yep.
Godfrey.
Yep.
He's here on the 16th, the following day, and this is where he jumps into a German's trench and gets clubbed to the ground and veineted in the groin. And he never really recovered fully from his
No.
experiences, from his combat
You
experiences
wouldn't,
here.
would you?
Yeah, no,
Yeah.
no, no,
Okay.
yeah.
So you mentioned the
41st Division.
41st,
So
yeah.
let's just say to start off with that perhaps the most important, or in my view, one of the most important memorials, or important, that's not a good word. Interesting, spectacular, unusual in a way, because we don't have very many depictions of statues of infantrymen on the Western Front. There aren't that
No.
many. Now, most of our memorials tend to be obelisks of one
Yeah.
description or another. But here we have a British Tommy in full kit,
Yeah.
rifle in one hand, other hand clenched, and looking behind him and almost waving his men forward. He's actually a private, and that's the 41st Divisional Memorial, and it sits this big bronze memorial in the middle of the town. Again, one of the reasons why we picked this town, we just thought it was such a beautiful
It
and
is.
an interesting memorial.
Yeah.
For those of you that haven't ever been here, if you have a look at the very famous books in about the fourth or fifth reprint, updated reprint, Before Endeavours Fade, by Rosie
Rough
Coombs,
terms, yeah.
then they've always used on the cover of that, they've always used the picture of the 41st Divisional Memorial at Flers. The most recent one is a colour photograph, which actually, oddly, I took for the editor who wanted a colour picture
Yeah,
for it, and
yeah.
that. I popped out and took a picture
Well, I'll
of
get a
it and
copy of
stuff.
that and we'll put that on my website that links to this podcast so people can see what we're talking about.
Very good book. If you haven't ever got it or had a look at it, it's a very
Yep.
interesting book. And certainly, she's remembered in Ypres for relaunching the battlefields in the 70s, really.
Yes. So,
40.
41st.
41st Division. So 41st Division, exactly the same. I just like the makeup of it. This is a proper pals division. It's the 41st Division, and yet wouldn't be recognised as one for people that were thinking of the Liverpool pals, the Manchester pals, the Hull pals, my home city, all of those pals battalions. But I'll just run through some of the units in the 41st Division attacking. So we've got the 18th King's Royal Rifle Corps. That's the Arts and Crafts Battalion. The 15th Hampshire Battalion, and that's the 2nd Portsmouth Pals. The 21st King's Royal Rifle Corps, perhaps one of my favourite battalions of the war. The Yeoman Rifles, they're from Yorkshire predominantly. The 10th Royal West Surreys, they're the Battersea Pals. 12th East Surreys, the Bermondsey. 11th Royal West Kents, Lewisham. 26th Royal Fusiliers, the Bankers Battalion. And the 32nd Royal Fusiliers, East Ham. So we can see predominantly London or the London area,
Yeah,
but
yeah.
all of the battalions attacking here are PALS battalions.
Be a lot of dockers in there, wouldn't they? Hard old
Yeah,
dockers from the East End.
there would.
I
Yeah.
want to come up against them.
No, so it's an interesting group, and the one that I've followed for a long, long time is the 21st King's Royal Rifle Corps, the Yeoman Rifles. And for anybody that's ever looked at the Yeoman Rifles, they're such an interesting battalion because they're raised in Yorkshire, slightly later than a lot of the PALS battalions, and yet they're not a PALS battalion. But Yeoman Rifles, what does that make you think of? Yeoman Rifles? You start thinking, Yeoman must be cavalry.
Horses, yeah.
And a lot of the blokes that joined thought they were joining the cavalry. They
Yeah.
thought they were joining the horse units,
Yeah,
but that
old
they
as a.
weren't, that they were joining an
A
infantry
brood
group.
awaiting for them when they turned up.
But it's mainly Yorkshire and it's mainly rural. There are some lads from the cities as well, but mainly rural farm workers' sons, and so it was a one of these real kind of local kind of units. The Earl of Faversham is the commanding it, so he's a local landed gentry landowner. He's a lord, so he's the guy that's raising it. He'd been in the Yorkshire Hussars
Yeah.
previously, but
But he's not with
had
them because he's too old, I suppose.
oh no, he is with them. He
He's
loses his
there, is
life
he?
here. Yeah, he's killed
Brilliant.
on
He's
the
leading
fifth.
from the front.
He's killed on the 15th, leading from the front. I'm going to talk about him later. He has.
Okay.
But he had, very unusually, he has a grave on the battlefield. Very unusual. His death is is terrible as well, in a way. He'd already taken his objective. He's one of those that reorganized in front of flares after the successful taking of the village. When the 41st Division reoccupies those frontline trenches, and he then receives orders to attack his next objective. Well, he's already in his next objective, so it was a misunderstanding. He thinks he's got to attack the next objective, and that it has decided will be too tough for the 15th. But he leads his men from the front over the top against the next objective. But there's no artillery support, no uncut barbed wire, because no barrage to protect them, and they're mowed down. And he's killed, leading his men from the front.
But he's got to follow his orders. He must know what's going to happen. But he's still got to follow his orders.
But it's not the right orders, because the orders were telling him to take his next objective,
which he'd already
not
got.
Realizing he'd already got it. So his body was lost on the battlefield. And men went out over and over again to try and find him, because it's like, for a esprit de corps, it's really bad news. And they'd had very heavy casualties during the day. And eventually another unit reported back to them that they thought they'd seen the body of a colonel in no man's land. And so they sent out yet a final group, and they found him, and they buried him on the battlefield. And that's where he remained until after the Second World War. And a great story, this. They built a proper building over him, brought a church bell from he lives near Helmsley, near Revo Abbey, right in the Yorkshire, the Yorkshire Dales.
Yeah.
And they brought a bell from his abbey. And so they built this building over his grave.
So we're still in the original field grave.
Yeah, in the field grave. And right. He was there until the 1950s. And after the Second World War, it had become all wobbly. And so they decided it was time for it to be taken down and for him to be moved. Now, normally, in many, many other cases like this, when they dig beneath, they can't find them.
Yeah.
And they're not there. But in this case, he was. He was. They found him. And so he went down to the AIF Cemetery, the Australian Imperial Forces Burial Ground at Grass Lane. And he's buried in there. I've taken his relatives around several times now. But there's a fantastic little epitaph to this. When I learned this story in the early days of moving here, I often wondered because there was a comment that I read that something was taken back. And I often wondered what that meant and what happened. So I went up to go and see my parents in Hull, and we went out for a day out, and we went up to Helmsley and then to Revo Abbey and then to Revo itself. And there's a little chapel there. And I stopped to go and have a look at it, as you always do. And there was the memorial. The whole memorial had been taken down, and it's been rebuilt. In the little cemetery,
with the big memorial that was on his field grave,
that was here on his
field
grave,
and they're taking it back to his home.
They took it back, and they rebuilt it.
Wow!
And the cross in the middle of it says, on the cross it says, a cross made from oak timbers found in the village of Flares. So
that is amazing, isn't it?
It is. So it's just fantastic. Yes,
and it also tells me, like so many of these men that were leading their divisions or their companies or whatever they were leading, was that they were, contrary to people's belief, they were very popular. And these men have gone to, they've put themselves in danger to go out to find his body. He was such a popular man, a popular leader.
Yeah, so it's a sad little story, and yet one that's got this nice tale. And you can go and see his grave in the AIF cemetery, and I know exactly what he did, and the men that tried to go and help him. And in fact, many of the Yeoman Rifles, the 21st King's Royal Rifle Corps, are buried in the two cemeteries associated with the village. One of them being Bulls Road Cemetery, and the other one the AIF Cemetery. I'm just going to read because we're just going to go back, I presume, to Dinner Ken and the story of that tank.
Yes.
But I just thought I'd just read you something, because when I read this, and this is written by one of the Yeoman Rifles, and it's on his return to the village in the 1920s.
Right.
And I just found this unbelievably moving and extraordinary. So this is from a book called A Kitchener Man's Bit, An Account of the Great War, 1418, by rifleman Gerald Dennis. And he writes on his return to the village, "We walked along the road to Flares. At the top of the hill, turned left, walked across a field of crops with permission from the farm worker, and came to the colonel's grave, all alone in its glory, and just where he had fallen on September the 15th, 1916. We solemnly placed our wreath against its cross, above which was a tiled roof on four wooden posts. We made our way to the village of Flares. How peaceful it was that afternoon. Sheep grazed around the raised green on which stood our divisional memorial. To us, the figure of a Tommy in battle order was a rifleman, and the simple inscription, 'To our glorious memory of those who fell,' engraved on the base was not necessarily to remind us of the purpose of that memorial. Its site there in Flares brought back a rush of memories of our chums, for did it not signify the beginning of the end of the Yeoman Rifles?" I just think that's so moving, of a man coming back not that long in the late 20s after he lost so many friends here. Yeah. And his colonel.
People love to see things like that, don't they? And certainly go and visit his grave next time I come to.
I'll take you there. You must pop in, and we'll go down there to go and see him.
Take some photos, can't we? So they've actually achieved many of their objectives that day. This is a bit like Mazantine Ridge after the disaster of the first day of the Somme. The 14th of July and the 15th of September are successful days, really, aren't they?
Yeah, this is a successful day, and you would have to view it as successful. In this area, I would say that the usage of the tanks for the 41st Division and the New Zealand Division is also successful. Mm. We have less success elsewhere. We haven't really talked much about the tanks with the 41st, but they equally did well. They roamed. A lot of the 10 tanks were knocked out. Some broke down. It's the same old story, really. I did have the figure somewhere of the overall day. Of what the tanks were. So this is the actual overall day of the Battle of Flares Corps Select for all the tanks. So 49 had supposed to have been available, but only 32 tanks are used. So of the 32 tanks, 5 ditched, 9 broke down, 9 were slow to arrive, and 9 got into the enemy lines. So only 9 of the 32 actually did their job at the time. 9 that were slow to arrive did very good jobs because they were mopping up as well. So I suppose it's 9 that were slow to arrive and 9 that got into the enemy lines of the 32. So overall, not brilliant, but it's a start.
Start somewhere, haven't you? And look at the legacy those early land ships or tanks. Look at where we are now.
Yeah, exactly. I suppose the downside is that the Germans then knew about them. Mm. And so when we next use them, the Germans have altered their gun positions so the guns can swing to follow tanks. They develop anti-tank rifles. They do simple things like reversing the bullet within their rifles. I don't know if you'd ever heard of that, Terry, but they actually took the projectile out of the bullet casing, turned it round, put it back in the casing, which meant that the bullet is not the pointy end, it's the flat end.
Is that what they call dum-dum bullets?
No, it isn't. That dum-dum bullet's something different. But what this is, it's causing an early cone charge almost. So it punches through the arm by superheating the lead inside, which punches through the armor. So it was just a simple. Who on earth invented that? I have no idea. But at the time. But it meant that when we used them in mass in 1917 during the Battle of Cambrai, the Germans were much more prepared for tanks, and that was how it was expected they would be used originally. Was in a mass use.
Then of course, as we get Cambrai. Again, everything we've learned from that day, has been used at Cambrai. But then all of these things come together, the tanks and the Air Force and everything else, in 1918, isn't it? Everything that we did on the 8th of August 1918, so much of it was learned from this day on the 15th of September 1916 and before.
Yeah, it is. And the final thing I think we should just quote is the report that was put out in the newspaper on that tank as it drove into the village. They described the art as walking, because the newspaper had no idea how to actually to describe a tank, and so they didn't even know how it was moving. So it was described as walking. So it was a tank is walking up the main street of Flares with the infantry cheering behind. I think is how it was. I think that was in the Daily Mirror. I think that was reported in the
It's a very
in the
famous
Daily
quote,
Mirror.
isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It
Yeah,
is. Yeah.
brilliant,
Yeah.
isn't it? And
Yeah.
there is a, if people come to the Somme, we talked about the memorials in the village of Fleurs, and there's also the tank memorial, which is up at, on the main road, isn't there, up at Poisier.
It is. I've always felt slightly aggrieved it's there. I can understand why it's there, because it's with
On the
the
main road.
Canadian. Yeah, it's on the main road. It's where the Canadians attacked, and so it's a nice memorial. I'm just doing a little bit of research on it recently, because this year is the centenary of it being placed there. So it was actually it's the centenary of it being built. It
1922.
went past with nobody kind of making any comment. I don't think I saw a comment hardly anywhere about it. And it was made by the tank engineering workshops in France, which I found interesting. They were still there, so they cast the bronzes, a little depiction of tanks, and built the memorial. It needs serious renovation work doing to it. It's looking tattered, and it's cracking, and
It's
bits
got
falling
battle
off it.
damage on it from the Second World War, hasn't it?
It has very famously the Whippet tank has a bullet embedded in it, so from the Second World War.
But it's still a very impressive
But
memorial
it is a
from
very impressive
highest
one,
point on the Somme, isn't it?
opposite the windmill site. Yeah, highest point on the Somme battlefield. yeah
Brilliant.
yeah
So, if people want to contact you and follow you, Pete, how do they do that? On Twitter? You're on Twitter, aren't you?
I am on Twitter. You know, I haven't got a clue what my Twitter feed is. I think might be Corporal's kit bag, but don't quote me on that. I
Oh,
have
they'll find you
absolutely
on
no.
Twitter anyway,
Yeah, somewhere.
and you're open to doing do you do private tours as well, or
I
just
do. Yeah, I do. You can find me under Fields of France,
Fields of France?
battlefield
That's your
tour.
website.
Fields of France, yeah,
Brilliant,
battlefield tours. Yeah.
excellent. So there we go. That's the story of the Battle of Fleurs-Corcelette, and I recorded that interview before the very sad news of the death of the Queen Elizabeth II. And next week I'll be doing a special podcast telling the story of the royal family during the Great War. But as usual, this week I'd like to finish by playing the last post to say thank you to all of the men that fell in the Battle of Fleurs-Corcelette 106 years ago.